It's been a long time since the scientists James Watson and Francis Crick gave the world a look at how DNA is structured in living things, the famous double helix. We know the structure of DNA. We know how it interacts with RNA, how genetic information is transmitted. Heck, science has even mapped out the entire human genome, and that's a decade ago. So we tend to take these things for granted now, but our guest this hour writes of how much work, time, and people it took to reach this point. Matthew Cobb's book is called Life's Greatest Secret, The Race to Crack the Genetic Code. Matthew Cobb lives in Manchester, England, where he's a professor of zoology at the University of Manchester. His work focuses on the sense of smell and the history of science, so it's clearly the second category that brought him to this book. Matthew Cobb, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Good to speak to you. Thank you very much for having me.
Sure. DNA and scientists, you put them in the same sentence, and Watson and Crick do tend to come to mind fairly quickly, but were there hundreds, thousands more scientists involved in the quest?
Well, there are two kind of phases to it. The first phase is trying to discover the structure of the DNA molecule, and that was quite a restricted group of people who were trying to discover that. I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 at most all around the world. Once the double helix structure had been discovered and the significance of it had been realized, then very quickly quite a large number of people got involved, and over the next kind of 15 years, then several hundred people all over the world were involved in it.
So what made the structure of DNA so important? Why was it so critical to understand that particular aspect of things?
Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, an awful lot of people didn't think it was very relevant. One of the mysteries of science is that the fact that genes are made of DNA was proved to most people's satisfaction in 1944 by an American scientist called Oswald Avery, who was in his late 60s. He'd spent his whole life studying pneumonia. And a lot of what he did was, in fact, now beginning to be sidelined by the development of antibiotics. But in the 1930s, he started investigating this very strange phenomenon in pneumonia bacteria, whereby there are two kind of versions of it. There's a nice version, well, not nice, but a non-dangerous version of it, and there's a very nasty version of it. And what people had discovered was that you could get bacterial strains to change from one kind to another by simply putting them on a plate next to some bacteria, and even if those bacteria were dead of the different kind, then they'd switch over. And this transformation really intrigued people, and Avery began to search for what he called the nature of the transforming principle, i.e. what was it in the bacteria that led to them switching from one kind to another. And to cut a very long story short, by the late 1943, and the article was published at the beginning of 1944, he'd shown that in bacteria this transforming principle was made of DNA. And a lot of people immediately got very, very excited. A guy in France went away and he showed that a similar kind of effect worked in E. coli, which is another bacteria. And he came up, this French chap, André Boivin, he said, well, look, you know, all genes are obviously made of this DNA stuff in all organisms. And in fact, he came up with some quite fantastic ideas about how we could actually transform organisms in different species using DNA, which all turned out to be right. Another young American called Joshua Lederberg was 19, and he was studying medicine, and he read Avery's article at the beginning of 1944, and he wrote in his diary, this is amazing stuff, and he immediately there and then decided to abandon his study of medicine and to start trying to work on bacterial genetics and on DNA, and within 12 years, he'd won a Nobel Prize. So an awful lot of people got very excited, but not everybody did. So there are two kinds of argument about, well, you know, this result actually isn't that significant. The first was from some of Avery's colleagues at Rockefeller University, who argued that, in fact, the extracts of DNA that he'd made weren't that pure, and there were tiny quantities of protein in there, and genes were made of proteins. Now, this wasn't an entirely crazy thing to think. It's what most people had thought before Avery had done his work, that genes were made of proteins, and the reason was very simple. Proteins are kind of infinitely variable. They can be any shape, and genes do virtually everything you can possibly imagine, whereas DNA, which was a major component of chromosomes, people knew that it was very important, but they thought it was just some kind of structural stuff because it seemed to be very boring and composed of just four elements, with these what we call the bases, A, C, T, and G. And so people thought, well, it can't be. Genes can't be made of DNA. They're not variable enough. It's tiny quantities of protein. So this kind of critical amount, critical attitude. And then some of the leading, very, very smart geneticists at the time, who went on to win Nobel Prizes, just didn't care. They said, yeah, it's rather weird. We didn't really get it. We thought, well, if it's made of this molecule or that molecule, who cares? We're interested in genes. So a lot of people didn't think that actually what genes were made of was a very boring, very interesting question. They thought that was just kind of chemistry. The man who really got it, the man who absolutely became obsessed by it, was Jim Watson. And Watson was a very young man at this time. I think he got his PhD at the age of 21 or something. And he went, he became obsessed with trying to find the structure of DNA. And in particular, he was really interested in one of the things that DNA does, which is it can copy itself. And we knew from looking down the microscope, looking at what chromosomes do, that they seem to, before a cell divides, they double up and then split into two. So there seemed to be some kind of doubling up going on. So Watson was obsessed with this ability to copy, that DNA molecules should be able to copy themselves.
And, of course, this is the Watson of Watson and Crick, who finally figured out the double helix and were widely recognized for it and are to this day. Much more about all the other people involved in unveiling what Matthew Cobb refers to as life's greatest secret than as the title of his book. We'll come back and talk more with Matthew and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about DNA and genetics today with Matthew Cobb, a science historian living in England and working at the University of Manchester. He wraps a lot of information from a lot of different scientists over a great period of time in his book, Life's Greatest Secret, The Race to Crack the Genetic Code, about all the people involved in unveiling things like DNA's double helix and all the things that have led from that research and led into it in the first place. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You were just talking, Matthew, about how young James Watson was when he adopted this work. I am struck several times over in the book by the youth, and there was a real youth movement here about people getting excited about the implications of DNA and its structure, who really charged headlong into it.
Yeah, indeed. They were very, I mean, Watson in particular was incredibly young. He, as I said, he got his PhD at the age of 21 or 22, I think, and when he was I think he was about 23 at the time, he decides to actually start finding the structure of the double helix. Now, he was a bit of a jackass, to be honest. He was incredibly smart, but he was also incredibly irritating. And he went a long way to irritating some of the people in London who were working on the structure of DNA, in particular Rosalind Franklin, who's now very well known. At the time, Rosalind Franklin was working in London alongside Maurice Wilkins, and they were both recruited to study the double helix structure, or to study the molecular structure of DNA. Now, Watson realized that the technique that they were using, which is called X-ray crystallography, which is basically, to be very crude about it, you take an X-ray of a crystal sample of DNA. He knew that the technique that they were using was going to provide him with the answer. The problem was that the X-rays that you get, it's not like, you know, when you go to the dentist or the doctor and you get an X-ray, you can see the bones in your hand and it's fairly clear what's going on. It requires a lot of complicated mathematics to understand exactly, to interpret these images. And Watson, whilst he was incredibly smart, didn't have the necessary math skills to be able to do that. However, the man who he shared an office with, Francis Crick, most certainly did. Crick was about 8 years older than Watson. He'd been in the war. He'd been working in the war on various physics kind of projects. And he ended up developing mathematical techniques for analyzing molecular structures on the basis of X-ray crystallography. So he and Watson were able to actually make their breakthrough partly or mainly as a result of, in fact, the work of Rosalind Franklin. And there's a lot of myths and rumors and stories that float about and partly based on Watson's own book about the period called The Double Helix, which is a fantastic book, but you shouldn't believe every word of it. And he makes a big thing there about what he calls Photograph 51, which was a photograph taken by Rosalind Franklin's student, Ray Gosling. And this photograph, which has got a kind of X shape on it, Maurice Wilkins showed this to Watson at the beginning of 1953, and Watson says, "My heart started racing, I got incredibly excited, I realized that the double helix, it must be some kind of helical structure." In fact, Crick never saw the picture. Crick was the guy with the math skills. And to make the double helix molecule, it's not just an idea of, oh, we got kind of, a double helix is a bit like a ladder. If you imagine a ladder and then you twist it, then you end up with the two strands going round each other, and the two strands are connected by the rungs of the ladder, which are pairs of bases. But actually working out the precise structure involved a lot of maths, and then building a very precise molecular model. So it's not just an idea, it's a very precise kind of hypothesis they came up with. And to finally, what really enabled them to make the breakthrough was a report, and a kind of informal report from the lab in London. Watson and Crick were in Cambridge, a report from the lab in London, which included some data that Rosalind Franklin had obtained of these numbers that Crick could then, with his slide rule and his book of log tables and his pencil and paper, because of course they had no computers, they didn't even have mechanical calculators, this was all done with slide rules, it's very, very hard maths, but done virtually in longhand, that Crick could then crank this through and come up with the key numbers that would explain how the molecules stuck together. The irony of the story is that Watson, 18 months earlier, had been in a seminar that Rosalind Franklin had given, in which she'd given out some of these numbers. She'd explained them. She'd put up a slide with basically these numbers on. But Watson was a cocky young man and didn't bother to take notes. Even worse, according to his own account, he spent his time kind of musing about, well, what's her dress sense like? Would she look better with her hair like this or like that? If he'd actually done the job and paid attention to what she was saying and written down notes, the whole of history might have been different. The key thing, however, is that Franklin, by the time that these data were handed to Watson and Crick, she'd already decided to leave the awful atmosphere in London, because she and the other scientist, Maurice Wilkins, just didn't get on. It was a great tragedy, in fact. They were like chalk and cheese and a whole series of misunderstandings. So she was kind of moving out of the area. She was going to move into of DNA. She was going to move into studying RNA at a different university. So she was kind of winding up. But we have her lab books. And on her own, without the kind of interaction between Watson and Crick, which was so important, the two could bounce ideas off each other, she was just on her own, isolated in this awful atmosphere. And yet she nearly got there. You can see in her notebooks that she realized the two things about the double helix molecule. The first thing, which is what excited Watson, is you can see how it can copy itself, because the two bits of the ladder are complementary. The bases can only bind together in certain ways. So if you know what one strand is, you can only immediately what the other strand is.
So whatever the ATCG is on this side, it's got to have a corresponding thing on the other side.
Absolutely. So this was the first article that Watson and Crick wrote on it. It's got this very coy sentence, which is very famous in science, that it has not escaped our notice that the pairing mechanism for the bases provides a mechanism for the replication of DNA. Watson, I guess that was from Watson, it was the kind of thing he'd say. And they were very pleased themselves about this, and Franklin realized that as well. But she also, like Watson and Crick, realized the really important thing, and this is why the people who said, well, who cares about the structure, were wrong. In that the sequence of bases is actually very significant. So although all the four bases, A, C, T, and G, are basically present in the same amounts, they are distributed in a particular order along the DNA molecule, and that's what provides the way a gene can function. That's what tells the cell what to do. That's the genetic code. And that's really the kind of, so this double helix structure of DNA is really the hinge of this book. I build up to it, I explain how they discovered it, and then I show the really interesting thing, I think, is how they then went on to actually analyze realize that there was a genetic code in the sequence of DNA, and that it could therefore provide the basis for how genes function.
The book is called Life's Greatest Secret, The Race to Crack the Genetic Code. Matthew Cobb is its author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join in as we talk about this exciting period in science history, a period we're still in discovering how genetics work and how we pass on traits from one generation to the next and how we are who we are, what we are. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's step back quite a few decades here. I mean, researchers like Gregor Mendel had figured out a few things about traits passed on quite a long time, but they just weren't aware of what the mechanism was. Is that the essence of it?
I mean, what Mendel did was to realize that something was going down the generations. And one thing, because I've spent quite a long time researching this, given lots of public talks and so on, what people find very hard to believe, and I initially had a hard time believing, is that until about the 1820s, the idea of heredity or inheritance of biological characters did not exist. So scientists didn't, there was no biological meaning of the term heredity. The only thing that you could inherit was a debt or a house or something like that, property.
But there were things...
You couldn't inherit a character. What happened was that in the 18th century, people, on the one hand, started to use selective breeding on a large scale to create new kinds of sheep. And secondly, people studied the pattern of inheritance of certain genetic characters, like, for example, polydactyly, having six fingers. They saw how it went down the generations. And they began to realize that there was this thing called heredity. There was a force in biology. And that's what Mendel, in fact, you know, we learn about Mendel, and he just seems like this kind of crazy monk who's studying peas. But in fact, it was a very applied piece of work. He was recruited to the monastery in Brunau in Central Europe in order to try and crack the problem. And his boss, the head of the monastery, Abbe Knapp, in 1827, he said the key question is what is inherited and how. So he actually, you know, understanding there was this new idea, he said, well, you've got to work out what it is and how it happens. And that's why Mendel started doing his work. He was basically brought in, you know, like a star sports player on the team to provide particular techniques and skills in basically Abbe Knapp's little research group. It was functioning like a university.
You know, it's refreshing to see you use terms like a gazillion to refer to the atoms we're made of. So,
I had an argument with the proofreader about that, but he let it go in the end.
That's good. I had to wonder about that because, I mean, there's a lot of other it's not inaccessible because it's not overly technical or anything like that. And gazillion really does freshen it up. But you know, you talk about the organization of those atoms dictated by genes. And there was a point in science when it seemed to the people studying it that seemed to fight physics. How was that?
Well, part of the problem, this is in fact where the idea of genetic code came from. In 1943, the physicist Erwin Schrödinger, who was an Austrian, he'd left Austria when the Germans invaded, and he ended up in Ireland, in Dublin. And he had to give a set of lectures, public lectures, because he had a new university post, and he decided to give them on life. And he wrote a series of lectures which are still in print, and a little book called What is Life? And he was very concerned because as a physicist, everything in the universe should obey the laws of physics. And the fundamental law of physics is that everything decays and is what's called entropy accumulates. The whole of the universe becomes increasingly disordered. So life apparently goes against what is called the second law of thermodynamics, because far from being disordered, life is the most organized form of matter there is. You know, we can do amazing things, living organisms. So he's quite concerned about that. So a lot of his book was about how life does and doesn't. In fact, it only kind of temporarily, because of course we all die in the end, we all turn back into dust, as a cheery thought for the morning.
and we'll go back to entropy.
In the end, the second law of thermodynamics triumphs. So the physicist was happy. But he was also concerned because genetic characters seem to go down the generations without changing. And so he became quite concerned about what it might be in a gene. And he came up with two things. Firstly, he said, and this is not before anybody knew anything about what genes were made of, although it was at exactly the same time, 1943, as Avery was finishing his experiments. It's quite ironic. And what Schrödinger said is that a gene must be some kind of crystal, a non-repetitive crystal, he called it, which is effectively what a DNA molecule is. It's a solid structure with a non-repetitive structure, and in that structure is the way that genes function. The second thing that Schrödinger argued is that a gene contains what he calls a code script, some kind of way of enabling the cell not only to carry out a particular action. So it's not like a blueprint, it's actually like a recipe book, but it's like a recipe book that also tells you how to milk a cow and make butter before you put it into the bowl, the bowl which it will then tell you how to make a clay bowl or a metal bowl. So it's actually an incredibly detailed instruction book because it contains not only the order of what you've got to do, but actually tells the cell how it will make it, so make itself, in fact. So Schrödinger came up with this very complicated idea of a code script and what it should do. He had no idea how it could work, and I think if anybody had said, you know, in 15 years' time we'll have cracked it, he would have been amazed.
So the book is his book is What is Life? Your book is Life's Greatest Secret, The Race to Crack the Genetic Code. Matthew Cobb is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. When Schrödinger came out with What is Life, you pointed out that he was in Ireland and not in his native Austria by this time. And it was fairly controversial. In fact, he got bumped from one publisher to the next, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he tried to. Well, it's partly his own fault. He very provocatively wrote a final kind of chapter, which weren't in the lectures, which he espoused his own particular version, very theist version of religion, and attacked the Catholic Church. And in Ireland at the time, and to an extent still now, the Catholic Church, well, certainly in the 1940s, the Catholic Church had a complete stranglehold on all aspects of culture. So the public, he was ready to go to the press, and then the publisher obviously got some kind of phone call or letter from an archbishop and got cold feet, and they, in the end, it was published by Cambridge University Press in the UK, and it's still in print today, and it's very well worth reading. And it was read at the time very widely, especially by young physicists. You've got to remember that in 1945, something rather, for most people, I think, rather awful happened. Physics was used to unleash the atomic bomb on the world. And this caused huge doubt and splits within science, because a lot of scientists, including people who were working on the Manhattan Project, once the Germans had been defeated in May 1945, and it was obvious that they were nowhere near getting an atomic weapon, then there was no need to carry on. And yet, obviously, the government carried on, and in August, they destroyed first Hiroshima and then Nagasaki. And a lot of physicists turned away from physics, and that include, for example, Maurice Wilkins, who was with Franklin working on the structure of DNA. And Wilkins had worked on the Manhattan Project, and he was so appalled by what happened. He left California. He read Schrödinger's book and was inspired. Crick and Watson both read it, and they all thought, hey, we can use these techniques of physics and ways of looking at the world to get at most fundamental things of life. So Schrödinger, although there's no kind of direct link, he was a force, he was an inspiration for a whole wave of scientists leaving physics. The great physicist Leo Szilard, for example, who came up with the idea of the chain reaction on a London street corner in 1933, he too abandoned physics after Hiroshima and Nagasaki and turned to what became molecular genetics. So a whole wave of people went into biology inspired by Schrödinger's book. And in fact, in 1953, after these two key articles were published by Watson and Crick, they sent a couple of copies to them of the articles to Schrödinger with a little note saying, we were inspired by your book and we think you'll be very pleased to see that, you know, some of the ideas come to fruition.
So up to that point, there'd been a fairly stiff wall, it sounds like, between biology and physics.
Yeah, I think that people didn't really get how the two were connected. And it's only when you can really understand the molecular structure and the relevance of things at that level that it becomes important. Although physics is very important as kind of shaping what life can do. So there are all sorts of, that's why trees are only go so high. It's to do with the laws of physics about the ability of getting water to the top of a tree. It's nothing to do with biology. It's to do with actual physics imposed limits on life. So physics is kind of the framework within which we live. But for understanding how the very basis of life exists, and indeed, to an extent, what indeed life is, which there's still no one definition of, then you need to have some kind of grasp of physics.
We have a question here from Jeannie in Medford, wants to know if DNA can prove that we descended from Africa.
Yeah, very much so, absolutely. So all human beings came out of Africa. We can trace our DNA back. And what is my book is basically a history going up to 1967, but there are four chapters afterwards which take the story to the present day. And one of the things they look at is the ability to study ancient DNA, including discovering ancestors who we didn't even know existed, and showing that we mated with these people, both in Europe and indeed in Africa.
It's really amazing stuff. The book is called Life's Greatest Secret, The Race to Crack the Genetic Code. We'll come back and talk more with Matthew Cobb, its author, when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the British science historian Matthew Cobb from the University of Manchester. His book is called Life's Greatest Secret, The Race to Crack the Genetic Code. We're talking about DNA and realizing what DNA does in making all living things what they become. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. A lot of great names, a lot of great anecdotes in here about many, many people involved in the process. Norbert Wiener, I want to bring into the discussion because he shows up a couple of times. Tell us about his contribution at the beginning of the process.
Yeah, well, so one of the things is that we talk about all the time today, both in computers but also in biology, is information. This idea that there's this abstract quantity called information that is being transmitted. And that's indeed what's happening. Our DNA transmits genetic information. So even though the same molecule may not still be around several generations down, something, what has been transmitted, is the information that's contained in the genetic code. And this idea of information was developed jointly by Norbert Wiener, but also by Claude Shannon. And Claude Shannon is probably still known to scientists today. He theorized this in something that's often called information theory, he called communication theory. But the pair of them were both working in the war on encryption and, above all, on anti-aircraft guns. And they came up with this idea of trying to of understanding that there is this concept of information. And they both kind of, because they're both mathematicians, turned it into a mathematical idea. Wiener was even more interested, in fact, in the idea of control and in the way that the flow of information around a circuit, be it a circuit of a machine or a cistern, like in the toilet, when you flush the toilet, the water goes back up to a certain level and the cistern turns off. And what's flowing around there, apart from water out of the cistern, what's the way it works is by this information moving around there, which tells the ball cock, tells the valve to stop flowing. Similarly, in an anti-aircraft gun, he was able to see that the way the soldiers interacted in firing the gun, in plotting where it was going to be, there was information flowing around there. And so Wiener came up with this idea of cybernetics, and he wrote a bestseller in 1948, Cybernetics, or the Study of Control in Machines and Man. And all the cyber words we use today come from Wiener. He came up with this idea of cybernetics. And this was a huge bestseller all over the world. Scientists all over the world got very interested in this idea of trying to understand systems, be they organic or electronic or mechanical, in the same way, using these concepts of information and negative feedback loops. And that turned out to be extremely influential for studies of the way that genes function. And we now know that many genes function by turning themselves off through a negative feedback loop. And some of the scientists in the 1950s began to play about with these ideas of cybernetics working at the level of the cell in the way that genes function.
Which is a big issue in our time now, if we can get certain traits to turn on and certain defense systems to turn on.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And interestingly, the other thing that Wiener did was he was very interested in the consequences, the social consequences of automation, because he foresaw all sorts of things. One of the things he suggested was, well, if we're just information, if the human body is just information, then we could technically reduce that information to a series of zero and ones and then transmit it somewhere and reconstruct that body. So the transmitter in Star Trek was devised by Norbert Wiener. He came up with the idea. And, you know, he had a great deal of thinking about this. He was also interested in the social consequences of automation, one of the things that is obviously very important for us today. And his writings were incredibly prescient in the late 1940s and early 1950s and had a huge influence.
I noticed that through the work of Wiener, and you mentioned Oswald Avery already about his rough and his smooth bacteria, that the term nucleic had been in use for a while, and variations in what we've come to call DNA, deoxyribose nucleic acid, I noticed in one reference. How did that all finally coalesce around the term DNA?
I'm not really sure, actually. I think the variations of the deoxy or desoxy were partly to do with chemists having arguments about vocabulary, which is beyond me because I'm not a chemist. I did just notice that all of a sudden people were using the full term, and then at a meeting in Cold Spring Harbor in Long Island in 1947, all of a sudden this abbreviation DNA started to appear, and then it took off. And there's a very similar kind of thing happened with the idea of genetic information. This idea is so obvious today. The idea of genetic information was coined almost certainly by Francis Crick in a second article they published in Nature in 1953, in which he just came up with this idea, and it came from Wiener's work and Shannon's work, which were discussed in the scientific community. It was in the zeitgeist. It was floating about. And then Crick kind of congealed it all into this idea of the genetic information being a code encoded in the sequence of the bases. And that idea was immediately accepted all over the world.
Now, Matthew, viruses keep coming in and out of this story. And by mid-century, were we even sure what viruses were?
Well, it was kind of a problem because I said that Oswald Avery got trashed because people said, oh, well, your DNA samples have got protein in them. And one of the reasons people gave for that was that it was thought that viruses were made of a protein because they'd been crystallized. The tobacco mosaic virus had been crystallized in the mid-30s and had been shown to be a protein. And Wendell Stanley got the Nobel Prize for that in 1946. Unfortunately, it was the other way around. His protein samples, in fact, had tiny amounts of DNA. So, in fact, he was completely wrong, and the Nobel was awarded for a result that turned out was within years of being shown to be incorrect. So, yeah, viruses were and remain a very mysterious, intriguing thing. Big argument amongst scientists whether they're alive or not. Most people would say they're not, but some people say it doesn't really matter. But they were incredibly important for these people to study because they were the simplest forms of life, or apparent forms of life, of biological organization that you could study. And they had these amazing effects. They could infect, in particular, bacteria. And there are a whole set of scientists working on these viruses infecting bacteria and trying to see how they were able to do this.
So I guess the question needs to be asked from a drop-back perspective. What did all the scientists think that cracking the genetic code would allow us to do?
Oof, yeah, I don't think that – probably not much, actually. I mean, they realized that they were going to be able to understand things. I think if anybody had predicted what was going to happen, and it's 50 years ago since they kind of completed the project, but even so, I think if anybody had told them what we were able to do 50 years, they would have been amazed. So the development of technology since then is quite astonishing. This was basically, they were just very curious. They wouldn't stand a chance in today's funding environment. You know, they would have had to say, we will be able to do X, Y, and Z, and Crick and Watson would just go, well, we've solved the secret of life and that's it. But, you know, we wouldn't know what to do with it.
How can we monetize this?
Yeah, well, exactly. That would have been a million miles from their thoughts or their ability. So they were just trying to work it out. On the other hand, Crick did very presciently in 1950s suggest that by comparing sequences, he thought of proteins, because DNA sequencing was still 20 years off. He thought by comparing protein sequences, you could actually understand something about evolution. So he came up with this idea that we could, in fact, that our biochemistry, in fact, can tell us an evolutionary tale. And he just kind of twigged that. That was really a stroke of genius. He was an amazingly smart guy. The point of my book was not to big up Francis Crick, but by the end of it, I just kind of ended up in awe of him because he came up with so many smart ideas.
He was the calm half of the duo, it sounds like.
Well, I don't know, not always calm. He had a reputation for having some pretty wild parties. And at some of those wild parties, there were scientists trying to think through key experiments, and they've written in their diaries about quite how hectic it was, with a lot of alcohol and who knows what else flowing about. You know, this was the late 50s, early 1960s, and I think they all had a whale of a time.
They did. In fact, you include pictures in the book. I haven't pointed out to this point. In fact, a picture of a party in there, and you just it all looks sort of dissolute, but somehow some good science came out of that group.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I was surprised to hear that the Waring Blender actually played a part in some of this research.
Yeah, it's a bit disappointing. So the Waring Blender is not the Waring Blender that you think of, all gold. And so, you know, people know about Waring Blenders in the States. In the UK, we don't know about them, so it doesn't have the same image, although I was told it was a kitchen blender, so I just assumed it was kind of, you know, chrome and glass. This was an industrial quality lab blender, and it was used in an important experiment to try and show in virus infection whether DNA or proteins were important. Now, in textbooks, and what the mythology that students are taught is that this was the decisive experiment. In fact, what I was amazed to discover is that Al Hershey, who was the guy who did this experiment, even after he'd done the experiment in 1953 at Cold Spring Harbor, this very important conference that took place every year, in 1953, Jim Watson says DNA is made of double helix structure. And then Al Hershey presents the results of the blender experiment, and the blender was used to shake the viruses off the bacteria that they'd infected. He presents the results of the experiment, and then he says, I'm still certain that proteins must play some role. I don't think it's just DNA. So the results were not as clear-cut as they're generally presented to be, and he was still stuck with the idea that proteins must be doing something. It can't just be DNA.
You have a great feel for some of the humorous sides of this, as we just referenced to the picture of the party in the book. And in fact, you include a letter that James Watson was one of the writers of. It was a spoof letter to Nature, but it ended up being fairly important in its own right. Explain that story.
Well, it became important for historians. So in 1952, Watson was in Italy, and he was getting liquored up with various friends in the Italian Alps. And they were all pretty annoyed by a guy called Joshua Lederberg, who I mentioned earlier on, who was this bright young thing who'd started inventing lots of new terms in biology, and in particular in bacterial genetics. So they wrote that what they thought was a joke about saying, we've got to replace these terms with the idea of bacterial information, and all this will be useful in understanding cybernetics in bacterial terms, or something like that. Now, this was a joke. The letter was, in fact, gobbledygook, if you read it carefully. But the editors of Nature didn't get it, and it wasn't very funny. And basically, they were just trying to take the mickey out of their rival. The irony of the story was that, in fact, that was published the week before the proper article on the double helix structure. It took a long time for the editor to decide to put it in. Now, bacteriologists and geneticists knew this was irrelevant, and only a few of them cited it, and all of them very critically. And then in the 1970s, when historians got interested in this story and were aware of the importance of the ideas of information and cybernetics, they suddenly saw this little article with James Watson's signature on it, and they said, wow, you know, this proves that they were really onto it. In fact, it doesn't prove anything at all, although what it shows is the ideas were in the air to the extent that people could make jokes about them. So it does prove something, but not exactly what the historians thought, because they didn't bother to think about, or didn't realize quite that, well, as I say, it was a joke, which Watson himself admitted rather sheepishly in the second volume of his autobiography.
So much work has built upon the work of Watson and Crick and all the other people whose work they built upon. But as you point out, in your own words, just knowing life's greatest secret is one thing. Science cannot tell us what to do with that secret. And so I'm curious to know, from your own perspective, if you're confident that we'll use it for the benefit of people and planet.
I don't know. It could go horribly wrong. We haven't done too well in the past when we started fooling around with genetics and human beings. You know, it hasn't always worked out, as I think we all know. And the big thing, and this is a global challenge, which I think all countries have got to come to terms with, is that about 3 years ago, two scientists, Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna, invented a new technique for directly manipulating genes called CRISPR. That's CRISPR, but without an E in it. And this is a technique derived from bacterial genetics, but which can apply to any organism. So we now have the ability to have targeted gene therapy, which will be much more precise, much safer than the previous versions of gene therapy, which were eventually kind of abandoned for a while. So we've got the possibility of changing people who've got affected tissues with genes that aren't working. In those tissues, we could change the genes in a very precise and accurate way. Much more alarmingly, there's the very real possibility that we could change our eggs and our sperm, so our germline, what we're going to pass on to the next generation. Now, if you are suffering from a particular genetic disease, this might seem like a no-brainer because you could eradicate that gene and there would be no possibility that your children would have it. But this clearly raises very delicate ethical issues. And as a planet, we're going to have to decide what to do about this, whether this is acceptable or not. There's also the possibility of directly manipulating pest species. And that's similarly worrying. We need to agree as a global society as to what is possible and what's right, because things could go horribly wrong. There's no guarantee if we come to an agreement we'll get it right, but it's too important to be left to the scientists, it's too important to be left to the politicians, and it's also, with respect, too important to be left to the patients. We've all got to come to an ethical decision about how to use these new techniques.
Well, robust history and lots of questions raised by it. Life's greatest secret. Matthew Cobb is its author. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Good to speak to you.
All right, take care.